This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we're going to have something I've wanted to do for a long time. We have many times on this show, in many, many ways, over many, many years, explored the feminine side of Wicca and witchcraft. But it has a masculine side too. We've only been there once in the whole history of Dreamland, and now we're going there a second time, because this is also a rich, rich history. And it's the right time of year, because we have Halloween, Samhain, all of these festivals happening at this particular point in the year. And so we're going to honor that on the show. I have often produced scary shows, and I read a scary one of my horror stories for subscribers one year and got about 6 responses. So I think I'm going to try a little something different this time. And to do that, I would like to introduce you to a really remarkable and remarkably talented man called Darren Mason. And I'm not sure I did that right. I think it's Dara Mason. Dara, can you get us clued into your name before we even start?
You got it right. Yeah, Dara Mason.
Dara Mason. His website is daramason.com. And on there, you will discover that he is an extremely talented man. I mean, to say the least, he is a brilliant photographer, award-winning. He is English and living in a lovely area called town called Hastings.
Irish actually, but I do live in England, but I'm from Ireland.
All right, well, please don't fly Christmas me, because
not
they might
all,
work.
Not at all.
They might work in your case. Yes, I've just. That is not the worst insult possible for an Irishman, but it's certainly in that direction. Anyway, he has beautiful photography on his website. Don't miss it, daramason.com. But we're going to be talking about something very different today. We're going to be talking about his new book, Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, Lord of the Crossroads. What an extraordinary story to Dara, and thank you for contributing this to the literature, because the dark man is dark, and that's why most of us know nothing whatsoever about him, but it's time to change that. All right, let me see how to ease into this. Okay, in Mark Adams's introduction, he talks about the dark man and his place in the witch's Sabbath. And I think maybe the best place for us to start is to go back beyond that a little bit to you. At some point in your life, you weren't interested in this.
Sure.
Then you were. What happened?
It's a great place to start. But before I get into that, I just want to say what an honor it is to be on your show, Whitley. I've been a follower, a reader, and a fan of yours for many years. So it really is an honor to be here. I guess where it started for me was... in the folklore. I spent many years looking at the folklore of the jinn from the Islamic and Arabic world. And that brought me back to Ireland, looking at the fairy folklore and the folklore of Britain and Ireland more broadly. And what I started to notice was this dark figure would turn up in the folklore, sometimes as the king of the fairies, sometimes as the folkloric devil, or sometimes a kind of anomalous lord of the dead. And it was striking enough that I was able to find more and more about this figure. And I did research into the Irish school's folkloric collection, which it can be found on the website ducas.ie. And what it is, it's a collection of folklore gathered from the schools of Ireland in the mid to early part of the last century. And I found more. And I found the Irish name for this figure, which is Onfar Durka, meaning the dark man in Gaelic. And as I was doing this research, I started my own podcast called Spirit Box about 4.5 years ago. And the goal of Spirit Box was to interview people who had a background in magic or had experienced the other in the form of spirits, and to kind of explore folklore further. And when I started to interview magicians and witches, this figure came up again and again as an initiator, as when people explained why they moved into witchcraft or magic, this figure would come up repeatedly. Not consistently, but he was there. This dark man, or the man in black, would appear in dreams or manifest in people's lives. And it was a call to initiation for some. And that was that's what brought it forward for me. I started to see the same passion occur in the folklore has occurred in the passions of these contemporary witches.
A call to initiation. This is one of the fundamental realities of human life and of the modern world, even though we tell ourselves, well, we're past all that now, that we're not. The spirit world is a myth. It doesn't exist. We stop here.
Yeah.
Not out there. This is our new modern myth. And it's as much a myth, maybe it's much more of a myth. The question is, where do you find him in yourself? Because he's in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we go any deeper, we're going to take a brief break for our free Dreamlanders. And I thank you so much for being with us. Please stay on after the commercials. They won't last long, and they might interest you. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dara Mason. His website, daramason.com, his new book, Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, Lord of the Crossroads. I find it all so incredibly poetic and beautiful in a way. And yet, there's this, he's not called the Light Man.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah, he's called many things. This is part of the mystery. You know, it seems to be a living archetype with a magical current, we would say, in occult circles, that he has many names, many faces, and perhaps no true name and no true face. But when you ask the question, where would we find him? We find him in our songs. We find him in our art. We find him in our poetry. As much as he is the initiator into witchcraft, he's also a driving force, in my opinion, behind creativity. And this is why the book is called Song of the Dark Man, because it leans into the element of inspiration, where people are driven to create, you know. And I talk at the start of the book that this is an inspirational and disruptive force. And we find this theme both within Arabic lore, with the jinn, who are said to inspire poetry. And we find it within British and Irish lore with the fairies, who are said to inspire music. All the best pipers were said to have been inspired by the fairies or taken to fairyland where they were given their songs and airs. And I think the creative force is something similar. And Jung spoke to it to a degree when he spoke about being in the grip of the daemon, one's personal daemon that drove one forward to complete a task, whatever that might be. And, you know, that's not an easy thing. I mean, Jung spoke about that being a challenging thing. He said, I had to obey an inner law which was imposed on me that left me with no freedom of choice. And similarly, what we see with the dark man, it can be in that territory. You look at, say, some of the great musicians of our age, where we have, you know, I guess the most famous of all account is Robert Johnson, the great blues guitarist, who was said to have gone to the crossroads, where he mediated with the dark man who tuned his guitar and handed it back to him. And when he took it back, he had wonderful musical talent, the ability to write fantastic songs, and wealth, women, and song. All this mythos is around Robert Johnson and his Crossroads episode. But it doesn't stop there. There's an account of Bob Dylan in the early 2000s. He was on 60 Minutes, kind of the American magazine show.
Right. You know it well.
Yeah. Well, he was asked, why are you still working? You know, what's compelling you to continue to work? And he replied, it goes back to a destiny thing. I made a bargain with it a long time ago. And he's holding up his end. And when he was pressed as to kind of, well, what or who exactly are you talking about? He said, with the chief commander of this earth and the world you can't see. And that description to
wow.
any witch or would be that's he's talking about the dark man, the old master, the old one. So he can definitely be found in our art. There's no doubt about that to me. And that goes back into our stories. And that's kind of the premise of the book. I unpack some of the old mythology of Ireland and kind of demonstrate how this shadowy figure is the one pulling the strings that links the age of heroes to the age of Christianity and now to modernity. But the striking thing about all of this is what we hear in the folklore, what we read in the folklore, is mirrored almost exactly in the world of witchcraft and in modern day experiences of witches. And in the historic experience of witches.
In modern day creative experiences, because what you're talking about with Bob Dylan, I mean, that happened, yeah. You know, that, and it certainly in my case, it's the same. I'm sure it is in yours as well.
Yeah.
No, it was not the dark man in my case. It was definitely mm-hmm. a woman.
Yeah.
But the inspiration was just as powerful. And I'm on that same path and I'll never get off it. I'll die with my boots on for sure.
Yeah, it is.
Let me see. Let's talk about fire in the blood. I think that's an important concept, and it's one that it fits right now in the conversation very well. What is this? What does this mean exactly?
So there's a concept within witchcraft known as witch blood, and essentially it's a phrase to try and encapsulate a difference that is within people who become witches, and essentially it can be a thing that might refer to lineage. Of some description, family history, that kind of thing. But it can also be seemingly quite random that people can have that with the witch blood essentially turned on or activated within them. And that's kind of why I use the phrase fire in the blood, as it kind of separates from ideas of kind of just genealogy and family lines. And while I do think that exists, I think it's a broader concept. So the way I kind of describe it is it invokes the illuminative qualities of inspiration and received mysticism that the dark man can ignite within us, within our hearts. And I would say, like, a determining factor of having this fire in the blood is like a sensitivity or an ability to work with the other world, you know. And that doesn't mean proficiency. That doesn't mean people are necessarily good at it or understand what's happening. You know, and this is why it's almost universal that we have mystery schools or shamanic traditions around the world, where people who are demonstrating these capabilities kind of just with natural capability can get that, get those skills refined and trained so they can master them and be in more control of them rather than at the whim or behest of them. You know, and that's something that we see is it's really missing in the West. You know, to your point about kind of the Western headspace can often see there's nothing else beyond my tangible material experience.
We've buried ourselves alive in our own heads.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what we've done. Mm-hmm. And speaking of burials and disinterments, it's time to take another break, and I'll figure out later why that connection is makes sense, or perhaps I won't. In any case, Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back. We're talking to Dara Mason about the dark man. His book is absolutely fascinating to me because it has it goes into a part of witchcraft that has almost been buried. I've interviewed people on this show who believe that witchcraft belongs to the feminine and that the male side of it really doesn't belong there at all. Radical, and I've been with even more radical witches who wouldn't do interview on my show because I'm a man. And what is going on there in the craft itself? Because you seem to have a place in the craft. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say. I mean, it depends on kind of where, you know, there's different types of witchcraft, you know, I think it depends on the type of coven or tradition that one is part of. It can vary hugely. You know, the royal spirit may be Hecate, you know, and in that sense is very much a female line. But if you look through the history of say the witch trials within Britain, particularly Scotland, you know, you will see that the leader of the witch's Sabbath is the devil, it is a male figure, you know, and it will be described very much as modern witches would describe, you know, a being that is part human, that can appear any way at once. It's a shapeshifter, a turnskin, can appear any way at once, part human, fully human, may appear as a deer, you know, but it's a male figure. And again, these are not universal things. It's hugely strong female energy within witchcraft. There's no denying that. But this initiator is very much a male figure. And if I could just go back a little bit to the fire in the blood conversation we had earlier, one important factor in this is within Islamic, more broadly Arabic lore, and within Irish lore, you have the concept of people who have fairy or jinn heritage, that they're not entirely human. And this seems to be connected with fire and blood. It's a consistent theme.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned the Arabic and the Irish mythologies together a number of times. What is their connection? Is there some kind of connection along the lines that Graham Hancock say might advocate that there were links between these cultures in the very, very deep past?
It's very hard to say, but I would imagine that there were definitely trade links. You know, I think where we have a lot of similarity is in the fact that kind of both countries or both areas of the world are dominated by Abrahamic faiths and within
nowadays, but they weren't all.
That's very true, and you're right to say so. I fundamentally think the link is there are two places that are experiencing the other through the cultural lens of their location in the world. So in essence, I would say in a very, very simplistic way that the jinn are Arabic fairies and the fairies are Irish jinn. You know, they are exhibit extraordinarily similar qualities. That the crossovers are ridiculous. There's an association with hidden treasure. There's an association with ruined places. There's an association with the dead. There is an association with child theft, with changelings. Down to the things like the jinn are said to travel in the wind. Well, the fairies travel in the shi-giha, the fairy wind. They're also harbingers of death. And I read a really interesting detail that I found in an anthropological book about Cairo, and then similarly found a newspaper clipping from the Western People, which is a newspaper from home in the west of Ireland. And the book is called Living with Jinns by Dr. Barbara Dryskins. And she talks about a particular taboo from throwing dirty water out the front door when you kind of, after you've cleaned your home, whatever, throwing the dirty water out the front door, that in Cairo you're supposed to say a kind of a bismillah to warn the unseen there that this is coming and to get out of the way and no harm is intended. And this woman didn't do that, and there was a black dog on the street. Now, the black dog is associated with the jinn. It is also associated with the good people. And of course, you'll hear stories and in folkloric stories in England of like the black shuk, this monstrous black dog terrorizing the moors and the byways and highways. So it's that in itself is a symbol of these spirits, a manifestation of these spirits. And the woman was struck blind for doing this. And then afterwards, it took her many, many weeks to get her sight back, many trips to sheikhs to do praying and exorcisms to try and get her sight back. And as she got her sight back, all she could see was the appearance of this, the impression of this black dog in her field of vision until her vision finally returned. Now, interestingly, they talked in the Western People of the same taboo that people in their croft cottages in the west of Ireland would shout a warning in Gaelic before throwing dirty water from their homes, saying, look out, ishka salaka chacht, dirty water is coming. And this one woman who didn't do it, and the legend says, is that her face was turned backwards overnight.
Backwards?
Yeah, around her head. So her features were on the back of her head. So we have almost like-for-like taboos. We have so many similarities here between the good people and the jinn, even down to the terminology that's used for them.
Maybe the connection isn't some kind of ancient seafaring at all, but the fact that the jinn and the good people are the same, and both the Arabs and the Irish are being taught by the same people.
I think that's a very strong proposition.
What an interesting thought. Gosh, I've never thought of that before. I've always seen these things as culturally isolated, and that any connection had to be kind of a physical one. But now I realize, no, what we're talking about is something very big here and very different.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, both
these... I'm going to have a lot of fun working with my head with this.
You know, and both these beings have you know, accounts of sexual interest in human beings.
You know? Yeah, I've noticed that myself. Yeah. Well, you know, you ought to write a second book, which would be about the relationship between the good people and the djinn.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah.
Oh, that would be fabulous. What an interesting idea. Let me, I've got a whole list of questions here. Isabel Gowdy's Confessions and Shapeshifting. Tell us a little bit about Isabel Gowdy and this whole remarkable area, folks. We're going to go down another path here that you're not expecting. So let's enjoy this and have fun. I'm going to take myself out of the picture and let Darren just do it. Darren Mason, Song of the Dark Man, darrenmason.com.
So Isabel Gowdy was tried for witchcraft in 1662 in Scotland, in the town of Aldern. And she made four confessions over a six-week period. And these are by far the most vivid and lurid confessions on the subject matter that we have. And it really is an extraordinary, extraordinary piece. But she talked about she met the devil on the road. This interrupted journey seems to be part of the pattern of the dark man. We see it in the fairy lore, where people's journeys are interrupted and they're given a challenge of some description by the mysterious dark rider. And this case is similar. Her journey is interrupted at midnight when she was walking along the road, and she meets the devil, or Black John, as he would refer to by what would become her coven. And he invites her to come to the church at Aldern and be initiated into witchcraft. And she gives this extraordinarily vivid account of what the witch's Sabbath was like, where she was given a devil's mark, and the devil sucked blood from the mark and spat blood into his hand and sprinkled it over and rebaptized her, renamed her. And she would partake in the Sabbath, the Sabbatic rites, which included carnal knowledge with this being, and described the feeling of that experience as being ice cold inside of her. And he said all the young women within the coven would lie with him and take great pleasure with him. He also taught them shapeshifting, and she recounted turning into a hare, turning into a deer, and the various different mischiefs that she would carry out at his behest, and been able to steal the strength from their neighbor's ale and what have you. And it's extraordinary. And one of the bits that kind of really jumped out at me from her account is it married up specifically with some ancient Irish folklore in terms of the specific detail of shapeshifting into a deer. And where I got this theme initially was from the Fenian cycle, which is this Irish kind of a compilation of Fenian stories. If you can imagine kind of the Irish King Arthur and the Round Table, that's kind of what you're talking about with the Fenian stories. They center around Finn McCool, who would be the Arthurian figure, and then his collection of warrior poets. And they're like this elite unit that had all these adventures with the other world in these collection of stories. And this dates back to, it's a collection of books called On Columna Shanarok, Which means the colloquy of the ancients or of old men. And it's made up of three manuscripts, two from the 15th century, the Book of Lishmore and Laud 610, and a third from Killiney in County Dublin, dating from the 17th century. But the linguistic evidence dates the text far earlier, to be the 12th century. And we have to bear in mind that these manuscripts reflect a far older tradition, a far older oral tradition of storytelling. And within this story, there's a story around Fionn MacCool hunting out in the woods near his homeland. And he comes across a doe, a female deer, that his dogs won't attack. And he brings this deer back into his fort. And that night, when he's lying in his chamber, the doe changes into a beautiful fairy woman who then enters his chambers and begs for his assistance in protection from a figure that she calls the Black Magician of the Men of God, or the Dark Man of the She. And the Dark Man of the She, or the Black Man of the She, is quite interesting, because the She is a word for fairy. And the Black Magician of the Men of God, or the Dark Druid of the Men of God, is a reference to the Tuatha Dé Danann, who are these the early kind of godlike beings and deities of Ireland. So she's transformed from a deer back into a fairy woman in the presence of Fionn. Fionn is then has to go away to fight some marauding Vikings as part of his duty. She waits for him to return, and she sees him coming up the road towards his fort, and runs out to greet him. But as she does so, this figure transforms back into the Dark Man, touches her on the head with a hazel wand, transforms her into a deer, and she's never seen again. Now, Fionn spends 7 years searching through Ireland to try and find her again. He never does, but he does find a child. And the child recounts being in another land with a deer who looked after him, and a dark man who would sometimes come and be very tender to the deer and sometimes be very angry with the deer. And Fionn realizes that's his child, Usheen. So the interesting thing is, Usheen is half fairy, and he's called, and the name Usheen means little deer or little fawn. And it's Usheen who is the vehicle to carry the stories of the Fianna into the Christian age, as he's said to have gone to fairyland for 3 years with his fairy wife. And when he returns to Ireland, he accidentally touches the ground and is transformed into this ancient, ancient man. And Ireland, is the age of heroes, is gone. And it's now the age of Christianity. And he ends up having these debates with St. Patrick, which are called the arguments. In the book of around Tuatha Dé Danann of Warriors and Gods. What's extraordinary, he has these debates with St. Patrick, and this is all documented by, you know, written down by Irish monks. Now, it's a story. But what it tells us is the monks, the Christian monks, were actually quite favorable towards Usheen. Usheen does very well in these arguments. But it links this period of time, the age of mythology and heroes, with the Christian age. And Patrick, in this book, is debating with a half-fairy being. And that's the first instance of the fairy woman turned into a deer. There's another reference in the Fianna where a fairy woman called Lady Mal is turned into a deer to trick two members of the Fianna to come to the kingdom of the Lord of the Dead, who is called Don Dove. And it works. They are brought to the kingdom of the dead. Now, Don Dove is an interesting name because dove means black. So we see this episode of someone being turned into a deer is done by somebody with the appellation, the Lord of the Dark Lord, the Don Dove, the Lord of the Dead. His name means black. And the magician that turned Saiva, the fairy woman, into a deer is on Fardov, the black man. The dark man, or the black magician of the men of God. So the appellation is consistent. What happens is consistent. There's another version of this story in the metrical Jinshaktas, which is a collection of mythological historic histories for the naming of Ireland and its towns, where a woman called Aiga is transformed into a deer and chased by evil spirits. Now, what's that got to do with Isabel Gowdy? Well, when she gives her account of how the dark man appears at the coven, she says, sometimes he appears as a man, sometimes he appears as a man with cloven feet, and sometimes he comes in the form of a ray. And a ray is an archaic Scottish name for a deer. So we have an inversion. And the researcher Joshua Cutchin, I'm sure you're familiar with his work.
Yeah, I think I may have interviewed him. Yep.
He describes inversion as representation when you're dealing with the fairy world. So we have a direct thematic link with the specificity of the transformation into a deer and this dark man. True names, true behavior, and his appearance as a composite being, and this interceptor trickster nature, and sex and sexual interest in human beings. It's the consistent pattern throughout.
That's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, it in many ways coincides with the close encounter experience and that lore and the lore that I have lived. I've lived with this, and I live with it today, right now. It's part of my life. The last time I had a big experience with it was with some friends in the woods in upstate New York 2 weekends ago.
Right.
Where it was a remarkable experience. And so this is real as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
When we talk about these things, we're not talking about some distant myth. We're talking about something that's real right now in the world.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that? Do you feel the same or not?
Oh, absolutely. It's world changing, you know, and we spoke earlier about being kind of, the moderns being trapped in their head and kind of being trapped, you know, in an empirical worldview.
We're blind.
Yeah.
Blind. We've gone blind.
Totally. And this is where the impact of the experience that people have recounted to me, and I've had my own experience as well, but the impact of it, when you're confronting something that is utterly alien to you, and you have no language for, there's no cultural references for it. Everything you've ever learned says this shouldn't exist, yet you're face to face with it.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yes, you have, absolutely. You know, and this is, I'm preaching to the converted here. You know, but
still, it's great to hear you talking this way, because it's very affirming to close encounter witnesses like me, because we're not encountering aliens from another planet. Mm-hmm. We're encountering something much, much larger that mm-hmm. could easily include that. But
it
includes our own dead. And mm-hmm. now I'm beginning to see that it includes this other level that is present in the Arab lore and in the Irish lore. And for that matter, it's present in England, in Scotland. The whole fairy faith of Northern Europe becomes involved, and the jinn become involved. And there are, I'm sure, if you go to India, into the Hindu literature, you'll find them there too.
Yep.
They're here.
Yeah. I mean, the Indian equivalent.
UFO either, did they?
But the Indian equivalent there's a type of being called a Yakshini, which is associated with the three spirits. And the sadhus who want to work with a Yakshini will recite certain mantras like thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of times to engage a Yakshini and create a relationship with them. And here's another thing that these Yakshinis demonstrate. If one has a sexual or a romantic relationship with these spirits, the Yakshinis, they have intense jealousy that human can never have a relationship with another human being again. Now you have the exact same thing with fairies, and you have the exact same thing with gin. So another cultural reference point.
You know, I had that actual experience in my life physically, because the lady who came, who originally abducted me, fell in love with me. There's no other way to describe it.
Sure.
And she started coming to the house all the time, and she was not comfortable with Anne at all. She would prefer to, she wanted to have our relationship in such a way that Anne kind of didn't exist in it.
Yeah.
And, but Anne did exist. And it was hard.
I can imagine.
Oh, it was very hard, because she kind of, in a way, it was also wonderful, because she really took care of the family. Mm-hmm. She became very, very involved with us. And like when my little boy brought up a child that she thought was not right for him, she drove that child out big time by, first of all, warning me by waking me up again and again in the night and showing me images of smoke coming out of the side of her mouth. The little boy had touched his tongue to a light socket when he was a child and had a scar. Right. And she apparently thought he was just the most fantastically irresponsible creature in the world, and my little boy should have nothing whatsoever to do with him.
Right.
Then the next morning, he said, the little boy said, "Mr. Strieber, I would like to go home." And he described, she had these long, three long fingers and a thumb and hooked claws on them. They were very soft to touch you, but it didn't look very pleasant. They were quite scary looking.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was taking them around the door of the bedroom where the boy was sleeping, and tapping her the nails on the door and scratching them up and down, and then the snake-like fingers would disappear, and she would wake him up again and again during the night. And he said, "Mr. Strieber, would you please take me home?" So I drove him home, and we never saw him again.
Mission accomplished.
But that's right. I mean, but what I'm saying here is, we're talking about, folks, something that's real and that's part of us and part of our lives and has been. How long do you think, Darren? Was here before us?
I mean, this goes back to deep antiquity, deep antiquity. I think that there's one really fascinating thing that is hard to get our heads around when we talk about families, you know, my view is that our idea of being an individual is probably, well, I theorize that's not how we're perceived by these beings, that actually we're perceived as the latest in the chain of our family, of our line, like we're pearls on a string. And we know that the other perceives time very, very differently to how we do.
Yes.
But there seems to be a familial interest that goes back through lines with some of these people who experience this.
Yes, in the close encounter world as well.
Yeah, yeah. And we look at it in terms of, like, you know, a banshee, which literally means fairy woman. Why does a banshee mourn? Why does she mourn the passing of a family member? There has to be a reason for that, that there's this fairy has an interest in that family's welfare. But by the by, in terms of how far this goes back, there's a piece of cave art that I talk to in the book that's located in southwestern France, and it's called the Cave of the Trois Frères, and it's home to a piece of cave art which is entitled The Sorcerer, and it's dated to approximately 13,000 BC, and it's a composite being. It's the being has been interpreted as having antlers, bear paws, owl's eyes, and part human body. And it was discovered by a guy called Henri Bruhl, who's a French Catholic priest, archaeologist, anthropologist, and he made sketches of this that were published in the 1920s, and theorized that the figure was a shaman. And a lot of thinking in witchcraft identifies the sorcerer. And there's a few other of these pieces of art. Another one called the Sorcerer in France as well, in a place in Dardogne as well, a very similar figure. And they appear as sometimes the dark. They are described and they're representations of what some would describe as the dark man in his composite being form, this therianthropic figure that is part human and part animal. This form, I theorize, is to remind the human being that we're part of nature, that we're not above it, but we're on an equal footing with it, that we're part of nature. And the dark man is a representation of nature itself. And you might say, well, why is that so terrifying? Shouldn't it be kind of like Gaia and all kind of like flowing, you know, green locks and, you know, flowers? And it's like, well, that's a misrepresentation of nature. You know, nature is tooth and fang. It's blood and claw.
Nature is ferocious.
Exactly.
And speaking of ferociousness, folks, here's a really tortured segue to, we'll be right back. We're talking to Dara Mason. His book, Song of the Dark Man, his website, daramason.com, that's D-A-R-R-A-G-H, mason.com, for those of you who are listening on podcasts. Well, you know what's going to happen is, how many podcasters sneeze on the air? Well, one that does, because my sneezes always catch up with me unexpectedly. I never have any warning. All right. You know, I'd like to move on here into the areas of psychopomps. And, you know, you talk about Shelley Porter.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Shelley Porter, and I think that we'll move it that through there into the whole idea of what a psychopomp is, and because I think it's, you know, most of my listeners are close encounter witnesses,
right?
And a lot of them are anyway, and so this could be very important for us to understand.
So Shelley is a hereditary witch. She comes from a lineage of witches. And when she was a little girl, she used to see a dark man at the end of her garden. And she wrote about this being, as she was a little girl, she wasn't afraid of the dark man at all. She thought it was a policeman when she was a little girl. But as she got older and started, I should add an important detail. Shelley was actually born dead. So she was born with an umbilical cord around her neck and had to be revived at birth. So that's quite an important note, because this would be in witchcraft circles be referred to as being born with a foot on both sides of the hedge representing the veil between life and death. And she's died several times. She's had a series of events in her life that have meant that she has come up against death firsthand, and in the book she gives an account of dying in hospital and the dark man appearing to her while she's in hospital and has left her body, and she remembers being in intense pain and her family members being there with her. And then the pain stopping and he appearing and asking her to go with him. And she's a very matter of fact person and asks quite straightforward to him, you know, am I dead? Do I have to go? To which he asked, you know, well, do you want to? And she said, no, I don't want to. I want to go back. But she talks about being walking through a desert with him and discussing what's going to happen. And the desert is an interesting motif because that gives us some kind of link to the jinn. Perhaps Shuli's based in the north of England. There's no deserts anywhere near her. But as it progresses, he takes her down into a place called the Dark Womb, which is this infinite water encased in a cave. And many people have been there and report being to the same place. And he immersed her in the water, to which she started to hear her heart beating again as she was healed. And she woke up again and the pain returned to her body. But she described the experience very vividly. She had great recollection of it. And has a day-to-day relationship with him, with the dark man. He's present in her life and she often hears him and sees him. I've been with Shuli where she's like, I can see him, he's over there by the hedgerow. Which was quite wonderful and disconcerting at the same time. But the psychopomp is the guide from this world to the other. And that very much was playing out in the experience of Shuli's that I just described. And this is where you have figures like Hermes would represent the same thing. And it's a guide. It's a guide to navigate between this world and the other. And the dark man seems to have that jurisdiction. It's definitely something there with him. And I mentioned the figure of Don Dubh, the Lord of the Dead, in Irish mythology. And that would very much place this figure in that territory of psychopomp and Lord of the dead and the underworld. And I think an interesting kind of theme that crosses over there is within fairy lore, when people are taken to the fairy kingdom and whatever's happening, where they're at a kind of a fairy festivity, they will see the dead. They will recognize the dead from their life or their family. And I believe the same thing happens within abductions. People see dead relatives.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so it's an extraordinary crossover.
It's because this is the same thing. I mean, the fairy folk, the djinn, and the visitors are all the same thing, I think. I think we Flash Gordoned them because it's the space age now.
Yeah,
but that's who we are. Let's talk about, speaking of that level of it. Gosh, there's so many directions I want to go in. I think that the trickster figure, the dark man, is a trickster figure. You need to explain exactly what a trickster is, I think. And then I want to get into what you get into in chapter 5, which is cultural change and social upheaval, because we are in a period of that right now all over this world. And some of it's good and some of it's scary. So yeah. Let's do that now.
So the trickster is a very, very powerful archetype that universally plays out in kind of whatever pantheon of gods you think of. There's a trickster figure within the Greek pantheon. You know, Hermes is a trickster. Within the Norse, Loki is the trickster. And you have like I think it's the rabbit and coyote in Native American tradition. So it's a global understanding that this force is there, and the trickster is one that is very challenging to deal with, because you never really know what motivations are behind it, or indeed how this is going to work out, you know. And this is why you have these kind of like myths around, you know, people trying to negotiate with the devil, and they kind of get what they ask for, but there's some sting in the tail, you know. And then to a kind of like a smaller level, a less kind of royal spirit level, where you have the whole thing of like trying to get the gold from a fairy, and you're given a bag of gold, but when you get home and you open it, it's just dead leaves, you know. So like those are kind of trickster qualities, you know. And like with Hermes, when Hermes is a baby, you know, he steals his older brother Apollo's calves, his cows, you know, and then makes up outrageous lies as to why it wasn't him, you know, which makes Zeus laugh so much he kind of forgives him and tells Apollo to kind of deal with it, you know. So his chaotic energy, or its chaotic energy to be more correct, is disrupts the apple cart, you know. It takes things in a different direction. It reminds human beings that we're really not in control, irrespective of our wealth, our health, our power, our position. Really, you know, we're not that in control. And
not at all. Well, pre-Dreamlander, speaking of being in control, I'm not in control of the fact that you won't subscribe to the site, but I wish you would. And even if you don't, I'm so glad you come to Dreamland, and so glad you watch and listen and leave all your wonderful comments, and those of you on the YouTube channel. I read them all, and I certainly respond as much as I can. Dara Mason, daramason.com. Song of the Dark Man. You can get it through unknowncountry.com. You can get it through Dara's website, which is, it's extremely beautiful. We've not talked about Dara's great talent as a photographer, but there is marvelous work there. It's a serious endeavor. So do take a look at that wonderful website. It's, speaking of magic, it is full of magic. And we'll see you again next week. Let's talk about the chapter, The Dark Womb and Rewilding the Soul. Mm-hmm. The idea of the dark womb and its significance in witchcraft. Yeah. Tell us what the dark womb is, and then we're going to get into this whole idea of soul renewal, which is, we're not going to last here very much longer if we don't succeed in this.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned this chapter, because it's probably my favorite piece in the book. It was also probably the most kind of inspiration driven. The piece we spoke about earlier, the Twofrere's cave, and the magician, or sorry, the sorcerer, the depiction of the sorcerer in the cave as this composite being. The reason I bring that up is to signify the importance and the antiquity of this spirit to our ancestors. To go in and create this piece of art in a cave 13,000 years ago would have been an extraordinarily difficult endeavor, very hard to do. To clamber deep into a cave, you know, no electrical light, to go and create this piece of art. So it tells us the importance of the being and the importance of place. Now, I pulled the thread on the idea of the cave as being that our Carns and passage tombs, but our Carns in particular, but called passage tombs, are recreations of the cave space that our later ancestors may have created. So things like the tombs of Newgrange, of Nowth and Douth in the Boyne Valley in Ireland will be very, very significant. And I propose that the idea of how we saw the earth was different. So we saw the earth, say, as the kind of the living embodiment, the living body of the goddess, right? Of the earth goddess. Now, if we take into account that you have on the winter solstice, after the world has died, the year has died, all the vegetation is gone, the food is gone. We're in a period of winter. On the winter solstice, the rising sun enters the chamber of Newgrange through a box above the entrance and illuminates the interior chambers. And at sunset, it enters the chamber of nearby Douth. And this is the solar phallus entering the vulva of the earth, impregnating it with life so it can begin again on the short stay of the year. So life will begin again as we build up to spring and build up to summer. This is the kind of it's symbolic of that cycle, you know, and this is, it's really important to understand that this is all designed in the language of symbolism. So it's impregnating with life to begin again after the lowest after the lowest point of the sun at the death of winter. Now, if we consider that the cave as vulva, it suggests a womb within, replete with life-giving waters. And this is what we refer to as the dark womb. Now, there's a mythological version of this that I'll touch on, but in terms of the dark womb that Shudi described, in meditation, some people go there and they experience a communication with him. I've experienced that myself. I know others who have. Some people call it slightly different thing, like the night womb or I can't think of another term, but essentially it represents the primordial cold furnace of creation, where all things come from, where all things emanate and return to. It's like a representation of the void. And the interesting thing about this, when we start to think about kind of the impact of say Christianity, is the glens and caves of Ireland were seen as the vulva of the goddess. There's two mountains in a place called Killarney in County Kerry, just as like Killarney in County Kerry, that are called the Pops of Anu. And these are two identical mountains with cairns on top that, for all intents and purposes, look like breasts. And they're called the breasts of Anu, the breasts of the goddess. So we have that idea that the landscape is the body of the goddess. But as Christianity overtakes the kind of the ideology of the island and the mind of the island, we see a transformation from the cave as the source of creation, as the vulva of the goddess, into the hellmouth, right? Into the hellmouth, where this is goes into the underworld and into hell. So it's a huge ideological shift, and one that has significant repercussions for how we see the world. But staying with the womb, there is an otherworldly source of Ireland's great rivers, which is called Conla as well. And it is said to be surrounded by nine hazels. And this is the same magic wood that the far dove transformed Saiva back into a deer with the magical wand. And the well represents this primordial dark womb. And it's as the kind of the spring of life and of inspiration. It's a womb of making and unmaking. And it's the source, as I said, of Ireland's River Boyne and River Shannon, the two great rivers. Now, The interesting thing about the it being surrounded by nine hazel trees is that they drop a hazelnut. Each tree drops a hazelnut into Conal as well. And these nuts contain the world's knowledge. And they are eaten by a salmon within the well, which then becomes the embodiment of all gnosis, all of the world's knowledge. And this salmon swims from these otherworldly waters into the rivers of Ireland, where the salmon is then caught and consumed by Finn McCool, who gains the gnosis of the world. He burns his thumb on the salmon. He's not supposed to eat the salmon. This is part of the trickster nature of all this stuff. He's actually cooking it for his druid master, who's spent his life trying to entrap this salmon so he can get the world's knowledge. But a blister arises on the skin of the salmon, and Fionn puts his thumb on it to burst it, and burns his thumb in the process and puts it in his mouth. And therefore, whenever he needs to know to answer to anything, he simply bites his thumb and the knowledge appears. But it's...
What did the druid master do?
So, interestingly enough, the druid master kind of just takes it on the chin, because despite his best intentions, it was prophesied that he would never get the world's knowledge. So that was his fight, that he would catch the salmon, but he would not eat it. So he kind of understood that was his part in the great play.
You know, I love talking about and thinking about this drama of the inner life that has some kind of a unacknowledged connection to the outer world. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think of the Vales of Ireland and the music. And I have a friend who's passed away, Laurie Barnes, who was in taking tourist thing in a little trap in through one of those veils, and she heard a beautiful flute playing, and there was a dark blue figure sitting along a riverbank playing the flute, and it was so small that it didn't look like anything that could play anything. I mean, it looked like, she said it was just very small, and you could see the flute was very small. And the other people everyone was looking at it, and they asked the driver, what is that? What's going on? And he said, we don't talk about that. What do you suppose was going on?
Well, I mean, first off, I understand his reaction. You know, generally kind of... interactions with the good people can have quite serious repercussions for human beings.
They're not called the good people because they are good. They're called the good people in order to make nice with them.
To placate them, absolutely. Yeah. The good people, the gentry. I mean, there's some areas... that's just called the other crowd or the lads, the lads beyond, you know. But again, going back to what we were discussing earlier, this the exact same motif exists within the Arabic world, you know.
Yeah,
where they won't say the word jinn out loud, you know. I've had kind of, you know, Muslim friends that when I start talking about this, they're like, "Can you please stop saying that?" So it's very much a consistent thing. I in terms of what was going on, I mean, for me, that's a classic description of a fairy of some description, you know.
Yeah,
particularly playing the flute, you know, there's said to be very fond of music.
Oh my goodness, what is it? I've looked up the William Allingham poem, The Fairies. Everybody who's interested in this should know this poem. Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen, we daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men. We folk, good folk, trooping all together, green jacket, white cap, red cap, and white owl's feather. you will find on the triangles of a triangular UFO a red light, a green light, and a white light.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's interlaced with this new technological appearance that it's taken on.
Yeah.
Do you suppose it is? You're so close to it. I felt that when I was reading the book. It just entranced me. And I thought, I'm being entranced by the dark man, by reading Darrow's book. It's got a lot of magic in it, man. It really does.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know it, and you're not afraid of it. What do you think that what do you want people to take away from this? What do they need to get from this? And why should it? I'm saying to people, you should get this book. And in fact, it's running on the crawl right now. Why?
I think there's two things I would say are valuable from the book, if I can say that about my own book. But the first one is the enchantment and the mystery, that what I'm setting out here, and you know, I'm not saying this is what this is definitively. I'm describing a pattern, and I'm explaining how the pattern shifts, how it's mysterious, and how it's been with us for a very, very long time. And what I'm suggesting with the idea of rewilding ourselves to understand it better, or to be in better relation with the earth around us, is to really examine our thinking, you know, to try and break our mindsets, you know, that are limiting us, that are kind of confining us in our thinking. You know, like people will sometimes go, well, you said the devil, so that must mean evil. And it's like, well, it's simply not that simple. You know, and while it's challenging in some ways, absolutely, and terrifying in many, many ways, absolutely, it's just too simplistic to say that is an evil force. It's just not the case.
But of course, that was said for hundreds of years through all of the years of persecution. You know, I believe next week we're going to have Dean Radin on.
Oh, and fun.
Yeah. And he's got a paper out that I've been using in my new book, actually, in The Fourth Mind, which points out that the I'm in the middle of talking and suddenly there's a great banging going on in here, and it's nothing mysterious. It's my next door downstairs neighbor. Hopefully he's not going to cause the entire building to collapse. Anyway, we're going to just have to live through it, folks. Dean points out in this paper, written with a number of other people, that there is a gene that makes us psychic, and it's not rare. It's a very common gene.
Oh, wow.
But not in certain Christian communities. And the reason is that they killed all of the people with this gene, mm-hmm. and they kind of blinded themselves. We talked about that earlier, going soul blind. And these communities are like where they really burned a lot of people in Central Europe and in Spain and in other, I think it's not so true in the British Isles and in Ireland, because they didn't do that much of it. But no. They literally blinded themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And now those people, if you go into the onto the internet, you'll find these people in these skeptic communities who are absolutely unable to see any of this as real. They mm-hmm. can't experience it. And I think it's because of their genetics.
I think there's an argument for that, yeah. You know,
yeah.
Like in Ireland, there were very few witch trials.
Right.
You know, and I mean, there were in Scotland. I think there was like, but there was like, we're talking like there was 4,000 people accused of witchcraft in the great witch trials.
And not that many killed either. I mean,
not all of them were executed at all. People were banished. I mean, there was a lot of people who died. I can't remember the exact figure. But not in the numbers that we're talking about in Central Europe. Like in Germany.
The Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Killed huge numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they might as well have cut out their own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Because and look at them, you know, we have an incredibly powerful anti-soul movement in our culture, and it comes from them. It comes from these people who have lost this gene. I'm sure of it. And the rest of us who haven't lost the gene, we wonder, you know, what the heck's going on with this? Why is it that I can see UFOs and my next door neighbor can't?
Yeah.
This is the reason, I think.
Yeah. 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 I think there's an argument for that, you know, and you know, it's also what kind of culture you grew up in, you know, where like, I think there's a culture of dual practice in Ireland. Like, you know, people would joke, the good people aren't real. That's just silly. That's, you know, we're modern people. And then at the same time, you know, somebody needs to cut down a fairy tree to make way for a road. Nobody will do it.
Right.
You know, so like, it's, you know, they're kind of talking out both sides of their mouth, really, you know, it's that dual faith where they're kind of overtly practicing Christianity, but equally there's a huge folkloric practice, you know, which is the remnants of the fairy faith there, you know. And I do think, you know, there is stuff around gifts that come down through people. I mean, my father is a seventh child of a seventh child, you know, like, and he's been seeing stuff all his life. You know?
I don't know about my father. He was a very mysterious man, a good man, and also a very hard man in many respects. And a man who had a lot of secrets, I will say that. That is very obvious. Well, listen, we have been together now for nearly an hour and a half, and I am being informed via text that there's going to be a great deal of noise here in a few minutes. And because they're getting ready to do something involving a saw. So I'm going to close out the show. I've enjoyed it so much, Dara. I really was looking forward to it. And I want everyone to have a wonderful Samhain, a wonderful Halloween, however you wish to celebrate it. And let's just, before we go, they're not blasting away yet. Before we go, tell us a little bit about your views of Halloween and what it has become. I'm curious what you think of that.
Well, I think it is a time where the veil is thin, you know, and our ancestors certainly believed that the masks were designed to hide one's identity from spirits, from hungry spirits that may be roaming. The lanterns were designed to scare away these spirits, but at the same time, people left gifts for them, you know, which is the exchange of sweets and treats and whatnot. So it was certainly a time when the veil was thin, you know, and there's an element to it of celebration that we have lost a bit around bonfires and lighting in the dark, you know, creating a light in the darkness, to mark the change in the time of year as we go into winter. But it is seen as that time when the spirits of the dead would roam the earth, and we would have a tradition of putting out what we call the dumb meal, which was a place at the table, at the family table, for those of our families who had passed, a plate of food for them, an offering to the dead, which is something that we've probably lost a bit in the modern version of Halloween. But again, we see similar traditions around the world. There's an awful lot of really interesting things that happen around this period of the year. Halloween is a wonderful part of that, you know, and it's a good reminder to us as well. It's part of that rewilding of the soul. You know, we're not always going to be here. And also, we don't know with certainty, you know, what else is out there. So it's a good reminder of that.
What exactly do you mean when you say rewilding? We haven't really defined that yet, and I think it's crucially important.
It is. It really is. And what I mean by it is it's the deconstruction of that Cartesian empirical mind, you know, and the experience you had, for example, so shocking that it changed your worldview, it changed the course of your life, you know. Experience I had produced this book, you know, but totally changed how I understand the world. You know, there are forces out there, intelligences out there that I do not and was not aware of or even believed in, but now I do. You know, now they're very much a part of my life. It's rewilded me. It has undone the kind of mechanistic Western thinking that blinded me, you know, to use your language.
That mechanistic aspect of it, the idea of man as machine, mm-hmm. is a big part of yep. Western thinking, because if you take away the soul, the numinous world, and life as a journey to another life beyond, there's nothing left but that. Exactly. There's nothing left but a kind of wandering. You know, one of the visitors once said that she said it to Betty Andreasen in old Gaelic. And I recognized the language listening to one of Betty say it in a recording as Gaelic. They thought it was a star language. And I got a translator who was skilled in old Gaelic to translate it. And it came out, children of the northern peoples, you wander in eternal darkness.
Wow.
Isn't that powerful?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
And that's exactly what's happened, because what's happened was the people who lost that gene have become ascendant, even in the intellectual part of the West, even though they're by no means the majority.
Mm. Yeah.
So, on that note now, I have survived the terrifying fear of the roaring saw or whatever, the entire room collapsing into the apartment below or what's ever about to happen. And we've come to the end of the show, Dara, and it has been an absolute delight. DaraMason.com, Song of the Dark Man. We'll see you again next week, folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.